All right, well, good morning. Very good to be here with you. It's nice to be standing room only. That's actually kind of unusual. There's a couple seats up front if you're interested. Again, my name is Don Warren. I'm a family physician. I also have a Master of Public Health, and I am the director of the Master of Public Health program at North Dakota State University. And we actually have the only MPH in the nation in which you can specialize in American Indian public health. So we're looking at American Indian public health as an academic discipline. And I really like the theme for this session, looking at capacity building and policy development. And what I'll be talking about is one of the things that we developed called a 638 toolkit. And it's interesting, if you grow up in California or Alaska, where our first two presenters are from, you've grown up under 100% 638 contracting and compacting. So you understand what it's like to have tribally run facilities, but you actually don't know what it's like to have IHS run facilities if you're in California or Alaska. Whereas where I'm from in South Dakota, we don't know what it's like to have tribally run facilities. It's all IHS. And as we will discover, we have a lot of advantages under tribal control as compared to Indian Health Service control. So I'll go into a little bit of the history of this. Of course, I have to start with disclosure. I have no financial relationships to disclose. No one's paying me to be here. I wish someone was, but nobody is paying me to be here. Yeah. Well, the graphic here on the left is actually right from the Indian Health Service website, and it describes the legal basis for federal services to American Indians and Alaskan Natives. And, you know, going all the way back to the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, which states that Congress shall regulate commerce among the Indian nations and the foreign nations as well. And then on the right is one example of many hundreds of treaties that were signed between the tribal nations and the U.S. government. This example is with the Potawatomi Nation from 1846. And I know it's in very fine print, but at the bottom it states that the United States giving at the same time promise of all proper care and protection. So in exchange for land and natural resources, we were promised all proper care and protection. Have American Indians received all proper care and protection? Not even close. Now, this is a treaty, and treaties are the highest order of law in the land. There's actually a treaty clause in the U.S. Constitution as well. And a treaty is a contract, and in this case, it's a contract between tribal nations and the federal government. The U.S. government is in breach of contract because they are not living up to these treaty obligations, which include health care. And, you know, when I look at Indian Health Service, I know a lot of people think of it, oh, it's free health care for Indian people. I don't see it that way. We gave up a lot of land and natural resources in order to have access to things like Indian Health Service. So I look at IHS as the largest prepaid health plan in history. You know, I was at a budget formulation for Indian Health Service when I was working in Arizona about 10 years ago, and one of the tribal leaders said it best. He said, if you want to get rid of Indian Health Service, that's fine. Just give us our land back. Don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, however. So when we look all the way back to the Constitution, again, Indian affairs are handled by Congress. We have a special government-to-government relationship that is unique to us as American Indians, which is why American Indian public health and health policy really is a unique academic discipline. We have our own legal basis. But the federal and tribal relationship has changed in form and substance by numerous laws, Supreme Court decisions, executive orders, and even recent laws like the Affordable Care Act, and specifically Public Law 93-638, and that's what we'll talk about here. So many of us have seen this type of information before, looking at the underfunding of the Indian Health Service. And we can see that various federally funded healthcare systems are funded at a much greater rate than we are in Indian Health Service. So Medicare, over $12,000 per person per year. Veterans, nearly $7,000 per person per year. Medicaid, over $6,000 per person per year. IHS, under $3,000 per person per year. And who was born with a legal right to health care? It's American Indians. So this, in truth, is a social justice issue. This is a civil rights issue. The U.S. government is in breach of contract with us as American Indian people. So if we're just dependent on IHS alone, are we going to get adequate services? No. Now, is that the fault of IHS? No, it's not. IHS does not determine its own funding levels. Congress determines the funding levels. But there's a way around this, and many tribes have figured this out through 638 processes. So if we look at the Indian Health Service, or the Indian Health System, between 1955 and 1975, it was just IHS. This, and, you know, 1955, when IHS was started in its current form, the world of medicine was very different. This is before Medicare, before Medicaid, before medical subspecialization, before HIPAA compliance, before JCO accreditation. The world of medicine was very, very different back in 1955. And as the world of medicine has evolved, quite honestly, IHS has not kept up with all of those evolutions in healthcare finance and administration. Well, in 1975, the new players were the 638 programs. That's when Public Law 93-638 was passed. It's the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. So it's interesting, now when we take over a program from Indian Health Service, the term 638 has actually become a verb, hasn't it? We're going to 638 the clinic, or we 638ed the hospital. So we know what we're talking about. We speak in our own code in some cases. Well, with the passage of the reauthorization of the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act amendments in 1988, that was the first time we were allowed to bill Medicaid. So there's a new player, and it included state government as well. So in any one community, we could have IHS facilities, tribally operated 638ed facilities, as well as billing Medicaid and working with similar state programs. Is this a complex web of health? Absolutely. Are there certain circumstances where one entity is assuming that the other entity is taking care of something? Or is there potential duplication of services? So we have a very complex system, and what I've observed is that the tribes who take over the management of everything do a much better job than the tribes who are depending on outside governmental agencies to provide services. And again, if you're from Alaska or California, you don't see this. You have all 638. But if you're in South Dakota, we have all Indian Health Service, essentially. So we have a lot of differences, and I apologize to my friends from Alaska. I realize that Alaska is not off the coast of California, but that's the best map that I could find here. But in the Great Plains area, it used to be the Aberdeen area of Indian Health Service, we have the lowest percentage of 638 programs in the nation. In South Dakota, we have 9 tribes of 17 facilities. Only one of them is actually operated by a tribe. That's Flandreau, just north of Sioux Falls. The rest of it are IHS direct services. So when we think about this from a broader context of the history of federal Indian policy, we know that there's all kinds of phases of federal policy. Early 1800s, removal, moving people to other parts of the country in some cases. When you look at the Trail of Tears, southeastern tribes being removed to what is now Oklahoma. Then in the mid-1800s, early 1900s, reservation and assimilation, people being put into reservation communities, but again, in exchange for things like health services. Indian reorganization in the mid-1900s, and there was actually a phase of termination. Many of the tribes in California went through this, and other parts of the nation as well, where their federal recognition status was just terminated. And the idea was to get rid of the Indian problem was to get rid of tribes' status. And then that changed in the mid-70s with the era of self-determination. And this actually started with President Nixon. And it's really interesting that when I think of Nixon, I wouldn't think that he'd be Indian-friendly, but he actually was. And he stated, "We have turned from the question of whether the federal government has a responsibility to Indians to the question of how that responsibility can best be furthered. We have concluded that the Indians will get better programs and that public monies will be more effectively expended if the people who are most affected by these programs are responsible for operating them." And I like what they do in Alaska through the Alaska Native Medical Center. They don't say we have patients, they say we have customer owners. The people who use the facility are customer owners, not just patients. In IHS, we are not customer owners. We are actually just patients that are being seen by Indian Health Service. So I actually looked into this. Why was Nixon so Indian friendly? Does anybody know? I actually looked into this. It's really an interesting story. He went to Whittier College in California, and his football coach was American Indian, and he also happened to be a philosophy teacher. And Nixon kind of looked upon this professor as kind of a father figure, and he really admired him, and he learned a lot about American Indian policy because he was American Indian and he was the football coach. So I would like to remind people that is why football is so important. Well, the Declaration of Policy in 638 is that the Congress recognizes the obligation of the U.S. to respond to the strong expression of Indian people for self-determination by assuring maximum Indian participation in the direction of educational services as well as healthcare services, to render these services to be much more responsive to the needs and desires of those communities. That's right from the law. One of the big advantages in 638 as compared to IHS is the ability to carry over funds. And it states right in the law, any funds for any fiscal year which are not obligated or expended shall remain available for obligation or expenditure during such succeeding fiscal year for which they were originally appropriated, contracted, or granted. No additional justification is needed. This is huge. Now, in the federal government, is it a good thing to have money left over at the end of the fiscal year? No. If you know the end of September is the spend down period. You got to spend all your money, because if you don't spend it, you lose it. So if you are efficient in the Indian Health Service and do not spend all your money, you are punished. Isn't that crazy? So you're punished for efficiency if you're IHS. If you're a tribally 638 program, you've 638 those dollars, you're efficient and you have carryover, you get to keep those dollars. That's a huge advantage, because when we look at our health disparities, we need to be planning 5, 10, and 20 years down the road. IHS tells us we have to plan October 1 to October 1. That's not efficient. It's not effective. We've proven that that doesn't work. So this opens the door to much more positive components of long-term planning. Now, one of the complaints that we have in the Dakotas is that many of our tribal leaders say if we 638, we're letting the government off the hook. You know, we have a treaty. They have a legal obligation to provide these services. So if we 638, somehow we're losing our treaty rights, and it's actually not true. It's written into the law regarding existing rights. One, nothing in the act shall affect, modify, or diminish sovereign immunity from suit. But two, nothing in this act shall authorize or require the termination of any existing trust responsibility of the U.S. with respect to the Indian people. So it says right in the law that if you 638, we're not absolving the government's trust responsibility to provide services. And this is something I've been trying to work with the tribes in the Dakotas to truly understand, is that it's not giving up treaty rights. If anything, it's an expression of tribal sovereignty within those treaty rights that we do not give up. So nationally, we're seeing that the majority of the IHS budget now is actually operated by tribes under contracts and compacts. You can see in 2003, it was about 42% to the IHS budget. In 2005, it was the first time it went over 50%. So 51% of the IHS budget was under 638 contract. And as of last year, about 60% of IHS budget is now managed by tribes. And we're seeing in those areas that where there's good self-determination contracting and compacting, we're seeing access to more services. So we're trying to get this to take hold in South Dakota as well. In terms of financial advantages, I already mentioned carryover funding. There's also a big advantage in terms of third-party revenue. The way it works now, if you're an IHS facility, the third-party revenue first goes to the area office, then gets distributed back out to the service units. Isn't that amazing? You don't do that in 638. You actually have your own billing numbers, and the revenue goes right to your facility. There's no reason to have a third-party intermediary when we're talking about third-party revenue generation for our services. So there is an advantage in terms of taking the area office out of the equation. Also, eligibility for grants. How many people are familiar with the Section 330 grants for community health centers under HRSA? Several people, very good. You may have heard of federally qualified health centers, and one of them includes the community health center system, and that's under Section 330 of the Public Health Services Act. So we have a network of community health centers all over the nation. IHS is not eligible for the 330 grants, but tribes are. So there's now about 35 tribal facilities, including Tuba City in Navajo, that's both an IHS 638 as well as a 330 grant recipient. For a typical clinic, it's about $600,000 a year. For a hospital, about $1.2 million a year in grant funding. So I've coined a new term. If you're a 638 and you get a 330 grant, you're now a 968. That's a lot of free money for providing the same services. But if you're IHS, you're ineligible. If you're 638, you are eligible. Contract support costs. Now, these have not been fully funded historically, but there's a Supreme Court case that says we need to be fully funded. Contract support costs are basically your indirect costs. So if you're a tribe, your indirect cost rate is 20%. And let's say you have a $5 million expenditure that IHS is spending on your health care. You get your $5 million plus your indirect cost rate, which would be another $1 million. So just going from IHS direct to 638, you increase your budget by your indirect cost rate, which is typically about 20%. That's not bad. So you go from 5 million to 6 million, and then maybe you get another 1 million as a 330 facility. These are significant advantages, and if we rely on IHS alone, we will never have the resources that we need. Also, you maintain your Federal Tort Claims Act, which is basically the liability insurance, so you don't lose that when you switch over from Indian Health Service to a tribally managed program. And liability insurance is very expensive, but we don't have to worry about that as 638 programs. We maintain FTCA. There's also the opportunity for Medicaid administrative match funds. The MAM dollars actually go to states typically, and those are the administrative funds to administer a Medicaid program for a state. Tribes are eligible for this, and some tribes have actually pursued this. So in addition to getting your administrative dollars from your IHS contract, you can get administrative dollars directly from CMS for Medicaid administrative match. If you work for the IHS, can you lobby? Are you allowed to lobby, Nancy? No. As an IHS employee, yeah. As a tribal leader, can you lobby? You bet you can. You can lobby for your needs as a healthcare system. And the tribal leaders then become the health policy makers. So this is really a unique and remarkable opportunity. And unfortunately, we haven't pursued it yet adequately. So what we did develop is a 638 toolkit. We have a couple copies. They're too heavy to bring a whole bunch of them with me. But if you email me, I can send you a copy of it. Yep. Within the toolkit, the components are overview of key data sets. So access to IHS data sets, the RPMS system, but also their census data, tribal enrollment data. There's also really good data sets that most tribes aren't using yet, like SEER. Now, I know there's a lot of public health people in here. So the surveillance, epidemiology, and end results data set, you can actually calculate your top 10 causes of death in a particular community. And you should be looking at all of these things when you're looking at the feasibility of 638ing. Community demographics is another section in terms of how to identify and describe community demographics. Health status within the community, again, using those key data sets. Role of Medicaid and third-party revenue. I know we do our best in many cases in IHS, but has IHS historically maximized third-party revenue? Honestly, no. IHS does not do as good of a job of billing as tribes do, because tribes are directly motivated to do a really good job at billing. And we've seen cases in South Dakota where there's just millions of dollars left on the table because of bad billing practices. IHS wasn't designed to be an administrator or a business of medicine, but that's what medicine is, and we need to maximize those revenues. Also, looking at purchased and referred care, formerly contract health services, there's a whole section within the toolkit on how to assess not only what has been expended, but what are the actual needs. Current 638 contracts, it's interesting, in South Dakota, every tribe has at least one contract, but it's typically not for clinical services. And you can see the other components, contract support costs, new tribal revenues. When we look at facility issues, there is the opportunity for what's called joint ventures, where the tribe can build a facility, then IHS is obligated to then staff it in perpetuity, so it's another huge opportunity for more revenue. And then Title I is contracting, Title V is compacting. And in the toolkit, we go into more details regarding that, as well as a timeline. So it's what we have developed for the tribes in the Northern Plains, but are happy to share it with anyone who is interested. And that's my contact information. So thank you all very much.
We have time for one question. Go ahead.
So you're talking about potentially voting right into a 638 process. So my question is, that assumes that you have the infrastructure in place to assume that responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious if you know facilities that have converted over, and if you have any guidance for developing that infrastructure.
Yeah, now there's several types of infrastructure. One, of course, would be the facility itself. And one of the components, in addition to joint venture, is some of our tribes have taken advantage of new markets tax credits. You may have heard of that. But essentially, it's a creative way to finance facilities in new markets. And essentially, in South Dakota, all of the South Dakota reservations qualify for new markets tax credits. And it's a complicated funding mechanism, but it's a tax shelter for wealthy people to put their money into new markets. And when you pay back the loan, essentially you're responsible for about 80% of what you borrow. So So it's a way to get $1 million, and it'll cost you $800,000. And it's to build new facilities. And these are available to any tribe that wants to take advantage of it. So that's one component that we have included in there. There's other types of infrastructure, including leadership and even having the expertise and the personnel. So there are opportunities even to partner with existing health systems within the region to do that. There's no reason in the world why you can't have a tribal facility that's in close partnership with an existing health network. All kinds of advantages with the Affordable Care Act. And in North Dakota, we did expand Medicaid. In South Dakota, we did not. So we're going to actually have a natural experiment between North Dakota and South Dakota. But within Medicaid expansion alone, that's huge for our people because of high rates of poverty. We ran the numbers in North Dakota. With Medicaid and Medicaid expansion, that will cover 60% of the American Indians in the state. Now, with the tax credits and with the reductions in cost for actually utilizing the marketplace, that's up to 300% of federal poverty level. That'll cover 90% of American Indians at no cost to the tribal member or to the tribe. So we've had tribal leaders say, well, what about trust, responsibility, and treaty rights? Well, in truth, you know, our treaties are not with the IHS. Our treaties are with the federal government. And these are 100% federal dollars that are going into Medicaid expansion and the marketplace, with the exceptions for American Indians. So we've ran the number. We can ensure 90% of the people in North Dakota at no cost to the individual or to the tribe using 100% federal dollars. So there's huge opportunities, but only if you expand Medicaid. Yeah.
So I'm from Idaho, so we did not expand Medicaid in Idaho. And we discussed helping
dollars. Yeah, one of the things that you can do, even if you don't 638 the facility, you can 638 your contract health services dollars.
Yeah, we have a 638 on contract health, but not the facility.
Yeah, so if you 638 the contract health services dollars, you can use those dollars to purchase insurance. And in truth, one of the biggest complaints against IHS is the contract health services system, or purchase and referred care, it's now called, where we run out of money. So you've heard the terms, you know, don't get sick after June. It's because we literally run out of money after June.
Yeah. October 1.
And if you are insured, you will never have a CHS denial again. So we actually have the opportunity, particularly under Medicaid expansion, where we could insure everyone. I look at the Affordable Care Act as the biggest expansion of Indian health in our generation, if Medicaid is expanded. And I think it will happen in other states over time. But I think the political issues are just that the certain states don't like the word Obama or Obamacare. So in spite, they'll spite themselves, essentially, to not expand. But eventually what's going to happen in South Dakota is that rural hospitals will close down, which will affect even wealthy non-Indian ranchers because they won't have access to a hospital. And then they'll expand Medicaid. But it's not going to be because it'll help the American Indian people.
One more question.
I'm curious if you've looked at the proposed legislation that's in the revision of ISDEAA.
Yeah, I haven't looked into the details of that. And in truth, I feel confident that things aren't going to get passed. They won't get signed into law by Obama if they're going to be negatively impacting us. So there's all kinds of crazy things that float around the House of Representatives. It doesn't necessarily mean it'll become law. All right, thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for our session and all the great speakers and information. So we will adjourn. So thank you so much.